Or maybe it was just that she had finally gotten to the wishful thinking part. She didn't care. Maybe this and maybe that, and none of the maybes mattered anymore, and that was actually a relief. The certainty was this. She couldn't hold the shelf any longer. She had only tilted it 3 or 4 inches anyway, 5 at the most. But it felt as if she had bent down and picked up the whole house by one corner. That was the certainty. She thought, everything is perspective, and the voices that describe the world to you, I suppose, they matter. The voices inside. With an incoherent prayer that the glass would remain in her hand when the shelf was no longer there to support it, she let go with her left hand. The shelf banged back onto its brackets, only slightly askew, and shifted only an inch or two down to the left. The glass did stay in her hand, and now she could see the coaster. It clung to the bottom of the glass like a flying saucer. Please, God, don't let me drop it now. Don't let me drop... A cramp knotted her left arm, making her jerk back against the headboard. Her face knotted as well, pinching inward until the lips were a white scar and the eyes were agonized slits. Wait, it will pass. It will pass. Yes, of course it would. She'd had enough muscle cramps in her life to know that. But in the meantime, oh God, it hurt. If she had been able to touch the biceps of her left arm with her right hand, she knew that the skin there would feel as if it had been stretched over a number of small, smooth stones and then sewn up again with cunning, invisible thread. It didn't feel like a Charlie horse. It felt like rigor fucking mortis. No, just a Charlie horse, Jesse. Just like the one you had earlier. Wait it out, that's all. Wait it out, and for Christ's sweet sake, don't drop that glass of water. She waited. And after an eternity or two, the muscles in her arm began to relax, and the pain began to ease. Jesse breathed out a long, harsh sigh of relief, then prepared to drink her reward. Drink, yes, Goody thought. But I think you owe yourself a little more than just a nice, cool drink, my dear. Enjoy your reward, but enjoy it with dignity. No piggy gulping. Goody, you never change, she thought. But when she raised the glass, she did so with the stately calm of a guest at a court dinner, ignoring the alkali dryness along the roof of her mouth and the bitter pulse of thirst in her throat. Because you could put Goody down all you wanted, she practically begged for it sometimes. But behaving with a little dignity under these circumstances, especially under these circumstances, wasn't such a bad idea. She had worked for the water. Why not take the time to honor herself by enjoying it? That first cold sip sliding over her lips and coiling across the hot rug of her tongue was going to taste like victory. And after the run of lousy luck she'd just been through, that would indeed be a taste to savor. Jessie brought the glass toward her mouth, concentrating on the wet sweetness just ahead, the drenching downpour. Her taste buds cramped with anticipation. Her toes curled, and she could feel a furious pulse beating beneath the angle of her jaw. She realized her nipples had hardened, as they sometimes did when she was turned on. Secrets of female sexuality you never dreamed of, Gerald, she thought. Handcuff me to the bedposts and nothing happens. Show me a glass of water, though, and I turn into a raving nympho. The thought made her smile, and when the glass came to an abrupt halt still a foot away from her face, slopping water onto her bare thigh and making it ripple with goose flesh, the smile stayed on at first. She felt nothing in those first few seconds but a species of stupid amazement and... Huh? Incomprehension. What was wrong? What could be wrong? You know what? One of the UFO voices said. It spoke with a calm certainty Jesse found dreadful. Yes, she supposed she did know. Somewhere inside. But she didn't want to let that knowledge step into the spotlight which was her conscious mind. Some truths were simply too harsh to be acknowledged. Too unfair. Unfortunately, some truths were also self-evident. As Jessie gazed at the glass, her bloodshot, puffy eyes began to fill with horrified comprehension. The chain was the reason she wasn't getting her drink. The handcuffed chain was just too fucking short. The fact had been so obvious that she had missed it completely. Jessie suddenly found herself remembering the night George Bush had been elected president. She and Gerald had been invited to a posh celebration party in the Hotel Sonesta's rooftop restaurant. Senator William Cohen was the guest of honor, and the president-elect, Lonesome George himself, was expected to make a closed-circuit television call shortly before midnight. Gerald had hired a fog-colored limo for the occasion, and it had pulled into their driveway at 7 o'clock, dead on time, but at 10 past the hour she had still been sitting on the bed in her best black dress, rummaging through her jewelry box and cursing as she hunted for a special pair of gold earrings. Gerald had poked his head impatiently into the room to see what was holding her up, listened with that, "Why are you girls always so darn silly?" expression that she absolutely hated on his face, then said he wasn't sure, but he thought she was wearing the one she was looking for. She had been. It had made her feel small and stupid, a perfect justification for his patronizing expression. It had also made her feel like flying at him and knocking out his beautifully capped teeth with one of the sexy but exquisitely uncomfortable high-heel shoes she was wearing. What she had felt then was mild compared to what she was feeling now, however, and if anyone deserved getting their teeth knocked out, it was her. She thrust her head as far forward as she could, pooching her lips out like the heroine of some corny old black-and-white romance movie. She got so close to the glass that she could see tiny sprays of air bubbles caught in the last few slivers of ice. Close enough to actually smell the minerals in the well water, or to imagine she did. But she did not get quite close enough to drink from it. When she reached the point where she could simply stretch no further, her puckered kiss-me lips were still a good 4 inches from the glass. It was almost enough, but almost, as Gerald and her father as well, now that she thought about it, had been fond of saying, only counted in horseshoes. "I don't believe it," she heard herself saying in her new hoarse Scotch and Marlboro's voice. "I just don't believe it." Anger suddenly woke inside her and screamed at her in Ruth Neary's voice to throw the glass across the room. If she could not drink from it, Ruth's voice proclaimed harshly, she would punish it. If she could not satisfy her thirst with what was in it, she would at least satisfy her mind with the sound of it shattering to 1,000 bits against the wall. Her grip on the glass tightened, and the steel chain softened to a lax arc as she threw her hand back to do just that. Unfair! It was just so unfair! The voice which stopped her was the soft, tentative voice of Goodwife Burlingame. "Maybe there's a way, Jessie. Don't give up yet. Maybe there's still a way." Ruth still wanted her to throw the glass. Nora Callaghan would undoubtedly have said that Ruth was heavily invested in the concept of payback. "Don't pay any attention to her," the goodwife said. Her voice had lost its unusual tentative quality. It sounded almost excited now. "Put it back on the shelf, Jessie."
"And what then?" Ruth asked. "What then, O great white guru, O goddess of Tupperware, and patron saint of the church of shop by mail?"
Goody told her, and Ruth's voice fell silent as Jessie and all the other voices inside her listened. She put the glass back on the shelf carefully, taking care to make sure she didn't leave it hanging over the edge. Her tongue now felt like a piece of No. 5 sandpaper, and her throat actually seemed infected with thirst. It reminded her of the way she had felt in the autumn of her 10th year, when a combined case of the flu and bronchitis had kept her out of school for a month and a half. There had been long nights during that siege when she had awakened from confused, jangling nightmares she couldn't remember. Except you can, Jesse. You dreamed about the smoked glass. You dreamed about how the sun went out. You dreamed about the flat and tearful smell that was like minerals in well water. You dreamed about his hands. And she was drenched with sweat, but felt too weak to reach for the pitcher of water on the bed table. She remembered lying there, wet and sticky and fever-smelling on the outside, parched and full of phantoms on the inside, lying there and thinking her real disease was not bronchitis, but thirst. Now, all these years later, she felt exactly the same way. Her mind kept trying to return to the horrible moment when she had realized she wasn't going to be able to bridge the last sliver of distance between the glass and her mouth. She kept seeing the tiny sprays of air bubbles in the melting ice, kept smelling the faint aroma of minerals trapped in the aquifer far beneath the lake. These images taunted her like an unreasonable itch between the shoulder blades. Nevertheless, she made herself wait. The part of her that was Goody Burlingame said she needed to take some time in spite of the taunting images and her throbbing throat. She needed to wait for her heart to slow down, for her muscles to stop trembling, for her emotions to settle a bit. Outside, the last color was fading from the air. The world was going a solemn and melancholy gray. On the lake, the loon lifted its piercing cry into the evening gloom. "Shut your yap, Mr. Loon," Jesse said and chuckled. It sounded like a rusty hinge. "All right, dear," the goodwife said. "I think it's time to try, before it gets dark. Better dry your hands again first, though." She cupped both hands around the bedposts this time, rubbing them up and down until they produced squeaks. She held up her right hand and wiggled it in front of her eyes. "They laughed when I sat down at the piano," she thought. Then carefully she reached just beyond the place where the glass stood on the edge of the shelf. She began to patter her fingers along the wood again. The handcuff chinked against the side of the glass once, and she froze, waiting for it to overturn. When it didn't, she resumed her cautious exploration. She had almost decided that what she was looking for had slid down the shelf or entirely off it, when she finally touched the corner of the blow-in card. She tweezed it between the first and second fingers of her right hand and brought it carefully up and away from the shelf and the glass. Jessie steadied her grip on the card with her thumb and looked at it curiously. It was bright purple, with noisemakers dancing tipsily along the upper edge. Confetti and streamers drifted down between the words. Newsweek was celebrating big, big savings, the card announced, and it wanted her to join the party. Newsweek's writers would keep her up to date on world events, take her behind the scenes with world leaders, and offer her in-depth coverage of arts, politics, and the sporting life. Although it did not come right out and say so, the card pretty much implied that Newsweek could help Jesse make sense of the entire cosmos. Best of all, those lovable lunatics in Newsweek's subscription department were offering a deal so amazing it could make your urine steam and your head explode. If she used this very card to subscribe to Newsweek for 3 years, she would get each issue at less than half the newsstand price. And was money a problem? Absolutely not. You would be billed later. "I wonder if they have direct bed service for handcuffed ladies," Jesse thought. "Maybe with George Will or Jane Bryant Quinn or one of those other pompous old poops to turn the pages for me. Handcuffs make doing that so dreadfully difficult, you know." Yet below the sarcasm, she felt a species of odd, nervous wonder, and she couldn't seem to stop studying the purple card with its "Let's Have a Party" motif, its blanks for her name and address, and its little squares marked DICL, MC, Visa, and Amex. "I've been cursing these cards all my life, especially when I have to bend over and pick one of the damn things up, or see myself as just another litter bug. Without ever guessing that my sanity, maybe even my life, might depend on one someday." Her life? Was that really possible? Did she actually have to admit such a horrid idea into her calculations after all? Jessie was reluctantly coming to believe that she did. She might be here for quite a while before someone discovered her, and yes, she supposed it was just barely possible that the difference between life and death could come down to a single drink of water. The idea was surreal, but it no longer seemed patently ridiculous. Same thing as before, dear. Slow and easy wins the race. Yes. But who would ever have believed the finish line would turn out to be situated in such weird countryside? She did move slowly and carefully, however, and was relieved to discover that manipulating the blow-in card one-handed was not as difficult as she feared it might be. This was partly because it was about 6 inches by 4, almost the size of 2 playing cards laid side by side, but mostly because she wasn't trying to do anything very tricky with it. She held the card lengthwise between her first and second fingers, then used her thumb to bend the last half inch of the long side all the way down. The fold wasn't even, but she thought it would serve. Besides, nobody was going to come along and judge her work. Brownie Crafts Hour on Thursday nights at the First Methodist Church of Falmouth was long behind her now. She pinched the purple card firmly between her first 2 fingers again and folded over another half inch. It took her almost 3 minutes and 7 fold-overs to get to the end of the card. When she finally did, she had something that looked like a bomber joint clumsily rolled in jaunty purple paper. Or if you stretched your imagination a little, a straw. Jessie stuck it in her mouth, trying to hold the crooked folds together with her teeth. When she had it as firmly as she thought she was going to get it, she began feeling around for the glass again. Stay careful, Jessie. Don't spoil it all with impatience now. Thanks for the advice. Also, thanks for the idea. It was great. I really mean that. Now, however, I'd like you to shut up long enough for me to take my shot. Okay? When her fingertips touched the smooth surface of the glass, she slid them around it with the gentleness and caution of a young lover slipping her hand into her boyfriend's fly for the first time. Gripping the glass in its new position was a relatively simple matter. She brought it around and lifted it as far as the chain would allow. The last slivers of ice had melted, she saw. Tempest had gone fugiting merrily along, despite her feeling that it had stopped dead in its tracks around the time the dog had put in its first appearance. But she wouldn't think about the dog. In fact, she was going to work hard at believing that no dog had ever been there. You're good at unhappening things, aren't you, Tootsie Wootsie? Hey, Ruth, I'm trying to keep a grip on myself as well as the damn glass in case you hadn't noticed. If playing a few mind games helps me do that, I don't see what the big deal is. Just shut up for a while, okay? Give it a rest. Let me get on with my business. Ruth apparently had no intention of giving it a rest, however. Shut up, she marveled. Boy, how that takes me back. It's better than a Beach Boys oldie on the radio. You always did give good shut up, Jessie. Remember that night in the dorm after we came back from your first and last consciousness-raising session at Newworth? I don't want to remember, Ruth. I'm sure you don't. So I'll remember for both of us. How's that for a deal? You kept saying it was the girl with the scars on her breasts that had upset you. Only that and nothing more. But when I tried to tell you what you said in the kitchen, about how you and your father had been alone at your place on Darkscore Lake when the sun went out in 1963, and how he'd done something to you, you told me to shut up. When I wouldn't, you tried to slap me. When I still wouldn't, you grabbed your coat, ran out, and spent the night somewhere else. Probably in Susie Timmel's little flea-bag cabin down the river, the one we used to call Susie's Les Hotel. By the end of the week, you'd found some girls who had an apartment downtown and needed another roomie. Boom. As fast as that. But then, you always moved fast when you made up your mind, Jess. I'll give you that. And like I said, you always gave good shut-up. Shut! There, what did I tell you? Leave me alone! I'm pretty familiar with that one, too. You know what hurt me the most, Jessie? It wasn't the trust thing. I knew even then that it was nothing personal.
that you felt you couldn't trust anyone with a story of what happened that day, including yourself. What hurt was knowing how close you came to spilling it all, there in the kitchen of the New Worth Parsonage. We were sitting with our backs against the door and our arms around each other, and you started to talk. You said, "I could never tell. It would have killed my mom. And even if it didn't, she would have left him, and I loved him. We all loved him. We all needed him. They would have blamed me, and he didn't do anything. Not really." I asked you who didn't do anything. "My father," you said. We were at Dark Score Lake on the day the sun went out. You would have told me the rest. I know you would. But that was when that dumb bitch came in and asked, "Is she all right?" As if you looked all right. You know what I mean? Jesus, sometimes I can't believe how dumb people can be. They ought to make it a law that you have to get a license, or at least a learner's permit, before you're allowed to talk. Until you pass your talker's test, you should have to be a mute. It would solve a lot of problems. But that's not the way things are. And as soon as Hart Hall's answer to Florence Nightingale came in, you closed up like a clam. There was nothing I could do to make you open up again, although God knows I tried.
"You should have just left me alone,"
Jessie returned. The glass of water was starting to shake in her hand, and the makeshift purple straw was trembling between her lips.
"You should have stopped meddling. It didn't concern you."
"Sometimes friends can't help their concern, Jessie," the voice inside said, and it was so full of kindness that Jessie was silenced. "I looked it up, you know. I figured out what you must have been talking about, and I looked it up. I didn't remember anything at all about an eclipse back in the early 60s, but of course I was in Florida at the time and a lot more interested in snorkeling and the Delray lifeguard. I had the most incredible crush on him than I was in astronomical phenomena. I guess I wanted to make sure the whole thing wasn't some kind of crazy fantasy or something, maybe brought on by that girl with the horrible burns on her bazooms. It was no fantasy. There was a total solar eclipse in Maine, and your summer house on Dark Score Lake would have been right in the path of totality. July of 1963, just a girl and her dad, watching the eclipse. You wouldn't tell me what good old dad did to you, but I knew two things, Jessie. That he was your father, which was bad, and that you were 10 going on 11, on the childhood rim of puberty. And that was worse.
Ruth, please stop. You couldn't have picked a worse time to start raking up all that old...
But Ruth would not be stopped. Ruth, who had once been Jessie's roommate, had always been determined to have her say every single word of it. And the Ruth who was now Jessie's headmate apparently hadn't changed a bit. The next thing I knew, you were living off campus with three little sorority Susies, princesses in A-line jumpers and ship-and-shore blouses, each undoubtedly owning a set of those underpants with the days of the week sewn on them. I think you made a conscious decision to go into training for the Olympic dusting and floor waxing team right around then. You unhappened that night at the New Earth Parsonage. You unhappened the tears and the hurt and the anger. You unhappened me. Oh, we still saw each other once in a while, split the occasional pizza and pitcher of Molson's down at Pat's. But our friendship was really over, wasn't it? When it came down to a choice between me and what happened to you in July of 1963, you chose the eclipse. The glass of water was trembling harder.
"Why now, Ruth?"
she asked, unaware that she was actually mouthing the words in the darkening bedroom. "Why now? That's what I want to know. Given that in this incarnation you're really a part of me, why now? Why at the exact time when I can least afford being upset and distracted?" The most obvious answer to that question was also the most unappetizing, because there was an enemy inside. A sad, bad bitch who liked her just the way she was, handcuffed, aching, thirsty, scared, and miserable, just fine. Who didn't want to see that condition alleviated in the slightest. Who would stoop to any dirty trick to see that it wasn't. The total solar eclipse lasted just over a minute that day, Jessie. Except in your mind. In there,
It's still going on, isn't it? She closed her eyes and focused all her thought and will on steadying the glass in her hand. Now she spoke mentally to Ruth's voice without self-consciousness, as if she really were speaking to another person, instead of to a part of her brain that had suddenly decided this was the right time to do a little work on herself, as Nora Callaghan would have put it. Let me alone, Ruth. If you still want to discuss these things after I've taken a stab at getting a drink, okay. But for now, will you please just... Shut the fuck up, she finished in a low whisper. Yes, Ruth replied at once. I know there's something or someone inside you, trying to throw dirt in the works. And I know it sometimes uses my voice. It's a great ventriloquist, no doubt about that. But it's not me. I loved you then, and I love you now. That was why I kept trying to stay in touch with you as long as I did. Because I loved you. And I suppose because us high-riding bitches have to stick together. Jessie smiled a little, or tried to, around the makeshift straw. Now go for it, Jessie, and go hard. Jessie waited for a moment, but there was nothing else. Ruth was gone, at least for the time being. She opened her eyes again, then slowly bent her head forward, the rolled-up card jutting out of her mouth like FDR's cigarette holder. Please, God, I'm begging you. Let this work. Her makeshift straw slid into the water. Jessie closed her eyes and sucked. For a moment there was nothing, and clear despair rose up in her mind. Then water filled her mouth, cool and sweet and there, surprising her into a kind of ecstasy. She would have sobbed with gratitude if her mouth hadn't been so strenuously puckered around the end of the rolled-up subscription card. As it was, she could only make a foggy hooting sound through her nose. She swallowed the water, feeling it coating her throat like liquid satin, and then began to suck again. She did this as ardently and as mindlessly as a hungry calf working at its mother's teat. Her straw was a long way from perfect, delivering only sips and slurps and rills instead of a steady stream, and most of what she was sucking into the tube was spilling out again from the imperfect seals and crooked folds. On some level she knew this, could hear water pattering to the coverlet like raindrops, but her grateful mind still fervently believed that her straw was one of the greatest inventions ever created by the mind of woman, and that this moment, this drink from her dead husband's water glass, was the apogee of her life. Don't drink it all, Jess. Save some for later. She didn't know which one of her phantom companions had spoken this time, and it didn't matter. Sometimes she was discovering it was impossible to take the mind's advice, no matter how good it was. Sometimes the body simply rose up and slapped all that good advice aside. She was discovering something else as well. Giving in to those simple physical needs could be an inexpressible relief. Jessie went on sucking through the rolled-up card, tilting the glass to keep the surface of the water brimming over the far end of the soggy, misshapen purple thing, aware in some part of her mind that the card was leaking worse than ever, and she was insane not to stop and wait for it to dry out again, but going on anyway. What finally stopped her was the realization that she was sucking nothing but air, and had been for several seconds.